You know how the worst people at any bar are the self-styled purists who loudly proclaim their hard-o opinions about craft brewers who sold out to big beer last decade, even though they rarely actually know what they're talking about? Me too. Why is that? And welcome to the Fingers Podcast. I'm your host, the Fearless Fingers editor, Dave Infante, and I'm coming at you from Fingers headquarters here in Charleston, South Carolina. Today I've got an interview with music journalist Dan Ozzie, author of the new book, Sellout, the major label feeding frenzy that swept punk, emo, and hardcore from 1994 to 2007. I met Dan a half dozen years ago when we were both still working in New York media, me at Thrillist, him at Noisy, Vice's music vertical. But these days, he's based in Los Angeles, where he publishes the music newsletter Reply Alt, and of course, writes books too. Fingers is no music newsletter, but when Dan first told me about his book, I immediately asked him for an interview. Having covered the rapid rise and somewhat rocky maturation of the American craft beer business over the past decade, when tensions ran particularly high about those small brewers that agreed to be acquired by macro brewers like Anheuser-Busch InBev, Molson Coors, and Constellation Brands, I'm always keen to explore how the concept of selling out shapes the relationship between art and commerce. In Sellout, Dan covers how 11 bands deal with the commodification of their creative output. Some acts do well, leveraging major label backing into global fame and lucrative careers. Others are destroyed by the pressure to produce hits and the disgust of one-time fans who saw them as traitors to the scene that made them. This, of course, should be sounding very familiar to anyone who is paying attention to the craft beer business over the past 10 years. In our interview, conducted on October 27th, 2021, Dan and I discussed the parallels between our two beats, his experiences reporting Sellout, and the perspective it gave him on the dynamic between creativity and commodity. We also figured out which band was the hard seltzer equivalent to the post-punk music scene of the late aughts. You can find all of Dan's work at danozzie.com, as well as information about how to order his new book, Sellout. And of course, before we get into the interview, I just want to thank you so much for listening and for being a paying subscriber to Fingers. Really appreciate your support on this project. Okay, with no further ado, here's the Fingers interview with Dan Ozzie, music journalist and author of Sellout. Hope you enjoy. Okay, Dan Ozzie, welcome to the Fingers Podcast, buddy.
Thanks for having me.
Dan Ozzie, author of a new book out right now, Sellout, the major label feeding frenzy that swept punk, emo, and hardcore 1994 to 2007. Dan, the book is out. It's receiving really good reception so far. You're joining the Fingers Podcast from NPR. So I know that this is the bigger press hit for you. People are loving the book, man. What's it feel like to have it out in the world?
Relieving. It feels like it's everybody else's problem now. Like in the month before it came out, I had to be like, you know, like every single day I had to schedule some kind of social media thing to be like, did you pre-order the book yet? Don't forget to pre-order it. Hey, when you pre-order it today, you get a free tote bag. And like, don't forget to like, and you know, like just try, look at me. Yeah, don't forget about me. And now it's like out and people are getting their copies and they're just posting them on the internet. And I kind of just have to sit back and watch it. I don't have to like be so thirsty on Maine anymore. So that's fun.
Yeah. You can go back to being thirsty on Finsta.
Exactly. Where it belongs.
Yeah. Where we'd all rather be. So Sellout is out. It's a book about, like I said, from 1994 to 2007, the sort of the selling out that some of the most popular bands in punk and emo and hardcore were doing. You've covered this space, not just for this book, not just for your previous book, because this isn't your first one, but for what? Going on a decade as a journalist, right? You and I first met when you were writing for Noisy. That would have been mid last decade, no?
I hate to think about it.
How long have you been covering the scene here?
Probably in earnest since 2013. So yeah, I'll be coming up on a decade. I Got two books under my belt in that time. It seems good. I'd like to do another one within the next couple of years. So we'll see. I don't know.
And the first book, just in case anyone hasn't come across your work in the past, is Tranny, Confessions of a Punk Rock's Most Infamous Anarchist Sellout. And the focus of that book, your co-author in that book, Laura Jane Grace, actually turns up in Sellout, of course. Her story is one of the ones that you cover. And that's sort of the bookend to sort of the arc of this current book of Sellout. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the arc? I mean, Fingers is, as you know, a drinking newsletter, not necessarily a music newsletter. I listen to music. Presumably some of my followers do as well. For people who aren't as familiar with how pivotal this period was in the music scene, can you kind of give us the top line, you know, why this was so significant in your view in forming the music industry sort of as we know it today?
Well, I see it as like an overlooked area. Like an overlooked era that was a very weird gray area, because before it, you know, in the 80s, this like independent rock music was Black Flag, Fugazi, Big Black, you know, like Mudhoney, just bands that were not interested in major labels, and major labels weren't interested in them. And so they got to just fly their DIY flag, and we look back at them as like heroes, right? Because Minor Threat played for $7, and we'll never adjust that for inflation. But then, you know, like in more recent years, rock music, popular indie rock music, was like the Strokes and the White Stripes and the Yeahs, and it was people who were like, well, yeah, fuck being poor. Like, we want to marry, we want to like go out with models and hang out with celebrities and be rock stars, you know? But there was this weird period in the middle that I grew up with that seemed to have gone undocumented until now, which is like this weird gray area where you had the shift from one era to another. And, you know, a lot of some bands were just, who were just kids, were getting offered like $1 million to make two records for Geffen. But there was this weird punk guilt that came with it, where you could take that $1 million check. You might lose your entire fan base, though, because they might turn on you. So I wanted to document this weird era that I lived through, where it was like indie rock meets fame, you know, like what happens there, and like the moral conflict, the ethical dilemmas that these people faced.
And just for listeners' awareness, the bands that we're talking about, I'm just going to rip through them real quick. Each one of them has a chapter in Sellout, but we're talking about Green Day, Jawbreaker, Jimmy Eat World, Blink 182, At the Drive-In, The Donnas, Thursday, The Distillers, My Chemical Romance, Rise Against, and then you wrap up with Against Me, Laura Jane Grace's band that we mentioned earlier. So some of those are probably pretty familiar to mainstream, you know, music fans. Some of them aren't, right? Because some of them never really broke through in the way that the Strokes and the Yeahs and the ones that came after really did. The reason I wanted to do this interview, Dan, and we were joking before we got on the recording here that, you know, where's the angle here, right? Like, people who drink go to concerts, people listen to music who drink, blah, blah, blah. But like, it's not necessarily the overlap. The reason I wanted to talk to you about this is because when you first started putting, you know, the info about your book, it teasing this new book that was coming out, immediately I clicked with this concept of selling out, because I've been covering the beer industry for the last decade-ish. And one of the dominant conversations going on in the craft beer business over the course of the past decade was, are we building a movement here, or are we just building this in order to sell these companies to bigger macro brewers? And what's the nature of authenticity? What's the importance of being authentic to the craft of producing beer? And it struck me, especially as I've gotten a chance to dig into Sellout, that there are some parallels here between what went on in the music scene, you know, between the mid-90s and the mid-2000s, and what went on in the beer business, in the American beer business, you know, between, let's say, 2010 and 2020. And so I think it's important, especially like these are both forms of culture. And, you know, like one is media, certainly, and the other is, you know, a consumable good. But I still think it's interesting to understand how this culture gets commodified or got commodified in the case of music, because it can teach us more about certainly what happened in beer, and then also teach us about what will happen, you know, in the future down the line with other forms of culture, as they, you know, fucking TikTok dances or whatever the case may be. That's kind of why I wanted to talk to you about this. So let's get into Sellout a little bit. I mean, who are the major players? Basically, are the big six record labels, but there are also mid-sized players as well. Can you give us kind of a lay of the land, an overview of the battlefield such as it is in the music scene at this time?
Yeah. Well, the book starts like immediately after Nirvana kind of changed everything, you know, because like I said, there were independent operations going on in music in the 80s. And then Nirvana came along and became like pretty much an overnight phenomenon. And record labels were like, give me more of that. You know, like, where can we get more? I don't know what the fuck that was,
but I want it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think a lot of them, there's this great quote that I love in the intro of the book that it was like in the New York Times in maybe 1991, where they asked the president of Geffen, like, how'd you do this? Like, how did you make Nirvana such a big, you know, like what happened here? And he was just shrugged and he was like, we didn't do anything. It was just like, get out of the way and duck. So I don't think that they knew what they had on their hands either, but they knew that kids liked it and they knew that they wanted more of it. And so, you know, they just went looking. They were like, okay, other bands in Seattle, here's okay, the Melvins, okay, here's whatever. And they were just buying them up. And then, like you said, and then eventually Green Day came along and that kind of like charted a little course for punk. And that's the slot that my book fits into. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but that was sort of like the, you know, the sort of primer for like when it started. And then after Green Day, you know, obviously Green Day was like I don't want to say a fluke because they worked so hard. They just captured something very special. But in a way it was like a completely irreplicable phenomenon. And so, you know, there's not going to be another Green Day. But again, record labels just thinking like, well, what if we just did the same thing we did for Green Day? Like, you know, it just doesn't work. And so I guess to answer your question about like the primary players, you know, and like the subsequent people in the book, it's like, you know, I tried to interview all of the band members and I tried to interview their A&R guys and I tried to interview their managers and fans and tour people. So it's just like a lot of people reflecting on this weird time.
One of the things that I thought was really, I think, important to decipher what's going on in the book and at the time is the reaction from the fans seems to sort of get more intense. And the bands at first are extremely reconciliatory when they do take this money, right? And like, how did that dynamic change between Green Day and Against Me between 1994 and 2007?
Well, I think Green Day are pioneers in a lot of regards. And one of the ways in which they are pioneers was, you know, I wasn't there in Berkeley at the time. It was 1993, 1994 when they got signed and I was a wee bit young. And I was on the East Coast. But from the people that I talked to, it seemed like in that brief time after they signed to a major label, but before they put out Dookie, there was kind of a feeling where, you know, like they played, like everybody knew them in town. They played there all the time. And it was maybe like I would describe it as like a light ribbing. Like, hey, guys, these jerks going to a major label. All right. You know, like, good luck, our little brothers, right. You know, kind of like a teasing aspect of it. But nobody, and I would bet probably even them, knew that they would become successful and knew that they would become so successful. So after that happened, everybody got, I think the vibe turned a little bit less ribbing into like, okay, you're gone. Like nothing personal, but like, you know, they always played at 924 Gilman, the fabled DIY club in Berkeley. And after they signed to a major label, they instituted a new rule there that said no major label bands. And it was because of Green Day. And it wasn't personal. It was just like, we cannot have what happened to Seattle happen here. So they were banished. And I think, you know, that really hurt them, despite the fact that they could literally, by the end of the year, play Madison Square Garden. They could play to 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 people. They couldn't play to this like 300 cap room. And I think it was dispiriting, you know?
Who's orbiting that type of ban? I mean, obviously there's a venue sort of runner in that case, but like who more broadly is kind of putting the kibosh on a Green Day?
There was, you know, like Berkeley, Gilman Street is like DIY volunteer run. So you had to, at that time, you had to have like a membership card to go there actually. And that was, I think that was actually a way of them getting around like a certain,
like fire code or liquor license or something.
Yeah. Oh no. Like a permit for like then it wasn't a venue. It was like a club technically. So whatever. But yeah, you had to like, if you were going to go, you had to like scrub the toilets. You had to do work the door, or you had to clean, sweep up afterwards, whatever. So, there was just a committee. There was just like a board that like gathered every week or something and was just talked about, you know, like what rules. It did seem like a lot of times, like what rules should we impose on our club? But really it was well-meaning to sort of like protect the sanctity of the club. Cause sometimes people were doing things that were like a little out there and it was like, well, should we have these people, you know, just like ins and outs of running this, operating this club. So after Green Day blew up, they convened a meeting and this guy, Jesse Lucius, who's in my book, he was one of the volunteers and he used to sing for a band called Blatz. And he suggested this rule, like, let's just not have major label bands because we can't have this. And to his credit, like, he was right, because after Green Day blew up, the club had all this influx of new kids coming in. Like, oh, I just discovered punk. I just heard Green Day and Rancid on MTV and now I'm punk. And so I'm going to go to Gilman Street. And so in a way, like, it kept them in the black, you know, and it helped them stay afloat financially for a long time, because all of a sudden every show was, you know, had people there. But at the same time, it sometimes, you know, he was telling me that like sometimes reporters wanted to film inside, like
right.
The home of Green Day. Where did, you know, can we film inside or for a news segment? And they were like, no press, you know, it's just still going to be a strictly volunteer run thing, but it's only for club members. And so their story in itself is a really interesting look at like an entity that suffers growing pains. And for them, it wasn't even through their fault. You know, for Green Day, it was like, yeah, well, obviously you fucking signed a major label deal. You made a huge video. You're on MTV. What did you think was going to happen? But with like Gilman Street, like they never really asked for that. You know, they didn't really try to become bigger. It just kind of happened to them because of Green Day and to an extent Rancid too.
I mean, that brings up an interesting point that, again, there's a lot of parallels for in sort of what happened to the beer business a decade later. But like, you know, Widmer Brothers, which actually is also out of the Pacific Northwest, they're out of Portland. They got partially acquired by Anheuser-Busch, which at the time was the biggest beer company in the world. Now is Anheuser-Busch InBev, still the biggest beer company in the world. And they got kicked out of the Brewers Association. I mean, this was more formal than a DIY venue in Berkeley, but same idea, which is that like, okay, it's no bad blood or it's not personal, but you've crossed a line. You're kind of with the enemy, or at least in the enemy's camp. Right. And you're no longer with us. And so you can't be in. And that it caused kind of a rift in the scene. It wasn't nearly as sort of vitriolic as it would get, you know, later in the decade when Goose Island and Elysian and some of the other bigger brewers that were more beloved sold out. But same idea there. And the reason I sort of bring that up is because one of the central questions, again, this is last decade. A lot of this has been either litigated to the point where people are just too exhausted to talk about it anymore, or they don't give a shit anymore because hard seltzer came and ate everybody's lunch and now craft brewing is no longer the bell at the ball. But the question I want to ask is, you did the book, you've covered the space for over a decade in earnest, like you said. Do you view that as a net positive or a net negative effect? I mean, you describe more kids found punk because Green Day and Rancid were on MTV. Does that outweigh the downsides?
Right. Sure. Well, you know, like one thing that you got me thinking about in terms of like the effect is, I think in any sphere, you know, beer or music, whatever, I think anybody that does partner with the machine has this really naive way of thinking, and maybe it's just their way of justifying it to themselves, where they say, I'm going to change things. You know, I'm going to sign to a major label, but I'm going to be a Trojan horse for these ideas. Or I'm going to do a deal with Anheuser-Busch, but we're still going to operate like, you know, we're going to change the system from the inside. And I think that's really naive to think that you can. I mean, it's wonderful to think that, but I always think of this thing that Ian MacKay from, you know, Minor Threat and Fugazi said. He was like, if you have two barrels and one of them is full of crystal clear water and the other one is full of shit, you can take a spoonful of the shit and throw it in the water and you'll see it. You'll see it in there. You know where it is. But if you take a spoonful of water and throw it in the barrel of shit, it's not going to have any effect on it. You know? And so I always think of that. And maybe that applies to what you're talking about with like these small brewers, But that said, like, I don't have any answers on like how to change the music industry's shortcomings. And it's like the monopolies that tech companies and record labels have. I don't have any answers. I would love to think that you could change it from inside, but I think it's like really naive. And maybe, again, it's just people's way of sort of like justifying that they're cashing a check.
Were any of the bands that you covered able to make what you would consider to be meaningful changes from within the major labels? I mean, maybe not, you know, net out, but like, were there any instances of them making substantial changes from within?
I think the one that did that the most was My Chemical Romance. And I admittedly like was the least knowledgeable about MyChem, but I knew I wanted them in the book because I really do think that they are pioneers in a lot of ways, because they stood at this weird change in the music industry where, you know, record labels were just hemorrhaging to streams and this file sharing and Napster, and they were just starting to tailspin, and it was scary, you know. And MyChem are really pioneers because that up until they came to a major label, they were so good at the internet. They were really one of the first bands that was like, we're going to have our albums or at least like samples or whatever for free on the internet. And like, I mean, now that obviously seems just the most obvious thing in the world. But going back to that time, like, can you imagine saying to your record label, like, hey, thanks for helping us make our record. So anyways, we're going to give it away. You know, it's ludicrous, like at that time. And so I really think that they are, if you want to talk about somebody who helped change the game, like the game was already changing for sure. But I think MyChem was a really good example of like, actually, this doesn't have to be a death sentence. You know, like the internet might actually help a band. And that was a weird time where bands were like, you know, previously, if you were a band and you wanted an audience, you had to go tour the country in your van and like play shows, and then you had to come home and then do another tour. But then at that time, there were like artists on MySpace who got MySpace famous, you know, like hadn't done a tour. Some of them hadn't even like really played shows, but yep, they had like a big following. And so like that era was coming one way or the other. And I think MyChem was the first one to show that like, actually you can do this and still not only turn a profit, but like build an audience.
So they were, I mean, that's an innovation that, like you said, now we just take for granted that, I mean, there really are not. Well, I guess people are still pressing albums, but more as a novelty thing than anything else. But that was something that they kind of introduced to the more like staid and hidebound world of the labels, which sounds like it stuck. I mean, even at the time, right? It was like people started mirroring what they were doing.
Yeah. It's funny too, because I really thought going into my research, I was like, oh yeah, their record label must have told these kids to piss off when they brought that up. But it was actually kind of the opposite. And their strategy, the label strategy, was so successful actually that I found this like business marketing book, and MyChem was like cited as an example as being like a success story, because what they basically pointed to was that, you know, previously in the 90s or up until the 2000s, whatever, for time eternum in the music industry, the record labels would just pick a single off of an album and they would service it to radio. And they would say, here you go, kids, here's the single that you're going to like this year. And sometimes they liked it and sometimes they didn't. And then then record labels were like, whoops, we were wrong about that band. Never mind. You know, MyChem's label kind of worked the opposite in that they were using the internet to like seed the tracks from the album onto sites like Pure Volume and Absolute Punk and things like that. And then they would just monitor the numbers. And then they were like, oh, this track is doing really well. Well, then we'll make that the next single. Like, kids,
I guess
really
that's
like
the single. Yeah.
So instead of just telling kids like, hey, here's what you like, they listened to feedback, crunched the data, and were like, okay, we got this many streams on this song, so that's the next single. So it kind of like, in a weird way, put the power in the hands of fans.
Yeah, for better or worse.
Yeah, there's definitely downsides to that, because like I have a friend who's in like film, and you know, he's in charge of like green lighting movies and stuff like that. And he was like, you would be horrified to see the process, because sometimes it's like they'll look at the data and be like, oh, people like horror. Like, it looks like they're almost like throwing it at a dartboard of like what people totally. Like. People like horror movies with social justice undertones starring, you know, I don't know, Zendaya or whatever. And they're like, make that movie. And, you know, they make it whether or not anybody actually wants to make it. And sometimes the audience doesn't even like respond to it because there's no heart behind it, you know. And instead of like giving it to a director whom they really believe, like taking a chance on a story or a director they really believe in, they're like, no, we'll just look at what like feedback says, like what viewer feedback says, and we'll crunch the data. So I do think there is definitely a downside to it for sure.
Well, and that's like sort of the tension that, I mean, infamously plays out in the music industry. And certainly you've covered a lot of this in your book, but really plays out in any creative space under capitalism, right? Which is that like these products, which is what they are ultimately, like can be informed by what the market wants to some extent, but you can't reverse engineer. That's where the artistry comes in, right? Is like people don't even know what they want oftentimes. And so trying to reverse engineer based on like existing tastes often wind up with like kind of a Frankenstein product that alienates the shit out of everyone that, you know, encounters it. Are there instances of that, like that you came across in research? Like were any of these labels trying to home grow like a counterpoint to a Distillers, to an At the Drive-In, anything like that?
Well, you know, like, sorry, I keep peeking a train of thought in my mind. But like one thing that you got me thinking of is like when it just goes wrong, because like you said, it doesn't have artistry behind it. I remember going to see, and I realize I'm a white guy saying this, but I remember going to see Get Out in the theater. And I was like, oh, this is a good movie. And this is like, yeah, it's like a horror movie, but it's really clever, you know, commentary on racial relations. And I was like, this is good. And then I was like, oh, fuck. Some dumb idiot at a movie studio, they're going to make more of these movies but not understand what makes this special. Sure. They're just going to be like, people like black horror? Okay. And it's going to become almost like a – almost like an offensive parody of it, you know, and that happens with everything. Whenever something is popular, you just get like 10 years of a watered down version where it's just like a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox until like you've gotten so far from what made that first thing great, you know. And Get Out was great because like they took a chance on a director who had a vision. They didn't try to like cram in some hokey messaging there. You know, they just like took a chance on this person who had something to say. And so like, yeah, I'm getting a little lost on the thread, but like artistry being superseded by data is very dangerous.
Right. Because you start with Get Out and then fast forward 5 years and you get like Karen featuring Taryn Manning, which is like just horrifying, like studio, you know, creation that sort of resembles it, but doesn't actually have anything that sort of gives Get Out its spirit and its essence, right?
And that happens with new music all the time. You had Nirvana and Pearl Jam, and then 10 years later, we got fucking Nickelback, you know? it happens with everything.
Yeah. One of the things I definitely want to talk about is like kind of your place in this scene and sort of when you first understood as a fan or as even as a journalist covering it, like the significance of selling out, like how much of a presence was that for you as you grew up listening to these bands? Like, did you spend time on the forums? Like, were you one of the dudes like shit posting about like whoever's new record label came out? Like, what was your personal sort of get in for this litmus test that you draw out in the book?
I think I was a little young to understand the nuance of the first ones like Green Day and Jawbreaker, because those were very heated arguments. And I was just kind of like finding this music. And so I was a little bit young. But in the early 2000s, I feel like a band signing to a big label was like a daily news hit that you'd see on Absolute Punk or Punk News or whatever, and people would throw their 2 cents in and get mad about it. But it was just kind of popping off in the early 2000s with like the type of Vagrant Records, Drive Through Records, you know, Saves the Day, Taking Back Sunday, you know, like those kinds of bands, like Dashboard Confessional. There was just like interest in that, and so it wasn't uncommon for somebody to make a jump from like a Vagrant Records, which is like a large indie or a mid-size indie or whatever, to a bigger label just because they got a bigger deal. And you know, like the comments were the typical like like, you know, AFI signs to DreamWorks. And then the comments would be like, wow, can't wait till they like butcher their sound, you know? And I feel like a lot of those records that came out got reviewed as much as like you can count words on Punk News as a review. It's like, it just got like almost dismissed initially, like just based off the logo on the back of the album. And so, and you know, like the Jawbreaker album, Dear You, which they should teach in fucking engineering school, you know, like it's just a perfectly recorded record by a master, just some savant producer, you know, at that time, as the second people heard it, they were like, too slick. Nah, it's too slick, yep. Too polished. Yep. Don't like it. Yep.
There's no winning, not punk. Basically. You know,
no winning. I interviewed Butch Vig for the book, who, you know, he's the drummer of Garbage, and he produced fucking Nevermind, Nirvana's Nevermind. Yeah. And he told me, he's like, every album I've ever done, you see people being like, oh, bitch, Butch Vig ruined that band.
Yeah.
And, you know, just by virtue of the fact that Butch Vig is going to do a good job on your record. So, there was no winning.
Butch Vig, I think, is a really good character in your book to sort of understand that dynamic, because his point is basically like, yeah, people are always going to fucking say this, log off of the forum. He's telling this to Against Me at this point towards the end of the book. He's like, we're going to like, if you like stick with the, basically like trust the process, like, and do a good job, we have all these resources at our disposal. We can produce the best fucking album. It's going to go huge. But he had clearly sort of made peace with that in a way that I think a lot of the band, the artists themselves, the bands themselves, based on your reporting, seemed to like struggle with. He basically had just been in the game for longer. So I guess had sort of like absorbed enough of the arrows that he had developed a thick skin.
For sure.
But, you know, there was real value to signing with a major label in terms of the way like the production was going, right? I mean, based on what I understand from your book, and then also just about the music industry generally, like the major labels are the ones who have the keys to the castle, right? Like they're putting you in the best studios, they're bringing you up with the best producers. Objectively speaking, the music tends to be higher quality. Is that accurate?
There's things that a major label could do, at least at that time, that you couldn't really get from an indie label. The main two were distribution, particularly to chain stores and particularly international distribution. If you were on like Lookout Records, which had Green Day's old records and Op Ivy's records, very good bedroom label, but they didn't put barcodes on their records. So that means you couldn't get into Tower Records or Virgin, you know, whatever. And then the other thing too was radio. Radio is this weird sort of like murky, like backroom dealing thing where you have to like know the radio guy or whatever and maybe pay him off. I don't know. But like major labels just didn't have the resources or indies didn't have the resources to really get bands on the radio very much. So, you know, a lot of bands like took the opportunity to go to a major label because it's like, well, okay, we'll at least have a shot at radio and a shot at bigger distribution. That said, it didn't always work. But at least it was like, okay, we're going to service this single to radio. And it did. It just didn't take off.
Yep.
But at least they got the chance.
In my strained sort of analogy across this interview here, looking for parallels in the beer industry, one of the things I mentioned earlier on in the conversation is, you know, eventually these conversations about authenticity and, you know, are you true craft, you know, if you sell out, et cetera, become moot because growth in that category slows. And what comes on really strong in 2018, 2019, and certainly 2020 is hard seltzer, this new product that is essentially pure commodity. It is purely about marketing and distribution, very little about the artistry and the craft that goes into producing the liquid. And that swings the balance back from this like artisanal approach that was very popular with consumers a decade ago and more towards, you know, let's go buy a 12 pack of this stuff that tastes like fucking wild berry and go.
I'm just realizing that Sum 41 is the hard seltzer of punk.
So this is what I was getting to is, you know, using that analogy, using that framework, if you'll indulge me, who is the band that is the hard seltzer of the scene that you were covering? You mentioned EDM in the book as kind of like the label's new sort of soulless cash cow, so to speak. Maybe that's in there. You mentioned Sum 41 just now. Like, who are you thinking about when you think about sort of the next turn sweeping through and kind of mooting this argument? Who are those bands? What does that sound?
I think Sum 41 is a great example. And then two, like, you know, the sort of like popification of punk that happened around that time, because it wasn't just Sum 41, it was Avril Lavigne, and it was to a certain extent, you know, Panic at the Disco, and it was just like these bands that were in the next generation removed, where it was like, okay, well, let's just make a pop version of this. Like, let's stop beating around the bush and just make a pop version of this. And that's probably what they did with Hard Seltzer. It's like, you know what? Can we just make alcoholic candy? That's what people would like. So let's just do that. Let's just stop beating around the bush. So I feel like, yeah, that era where it was like MTV, Good Charlotte, those types of bands probably were the Hard Seltzers that we're talking about.
Sure. That makes sense. Yeah. And you're exactly right. I mean, like, for a while, people were doing like hard sodas. We're like, oh, this is craft hard soda. It's like, nope, you're really close. But like, really what they just fucking want is hard seltzer. Just make that shit, you know? Let's bring it home here. We didn't even get a chance to talk about the bands. We'll quickly sort of refer to them. You'll have to, if you're listening to this and you want to know more about the bands, you'll have to pick up Sell Out by Dan Ozzie. It's an incredible book. I really have enjoyed it so far. And he covers, what is it? Is it a dozen all in? Is it 11 maybe?
11
bands all in. Mm-hmm. And takes you through the trip. Dan, I'm curious, having, you spent what, 2 years with this book?
Yeah.
Put a ton of work into it. It's obvious. It's very clear, you know, ton of care. You obviously really give a shit about the scene and the people that you cover. You now have a little bit of remove. Like you said, the book is out in the world. It's everyone else's problem now. You get to sort of start thinking about maybe your own reactions to the project or what the project sort of, you know, has left you with. One thing I'm curious to know specifically with regards to sort of the relationship between art and commodity is, what did you learn from reporting this book about those perennially opposed forces? Who wins? Who won in this case? Who wins, you know, generally? The easy answer, right, is like follow the money. I'm curious to know if you found counterpoints to that in your research and reporting that sort of give you hope that art can prevail on that dynamic from time to time.
Right. I mean, I guess
big fucking question, Dan.
Yeah, and I don't know how, if I'll answer it well, but I'll take a crack at it. But I think who wins always is capitalism, right? Capitalism always wins. However, you know, like I do think that now this kind of music is in an interesting place in that, like, it always, like, people are always going to make their own music. And I think it's interesting now that people can do that on an independent scale that is also large scale. And, you know, like during the pandemic, so many venues closed and people were so sad about it. And it was heartbreaking for sure. I just want to be clear about that. But at the same time too, like I tried to take an optimistic view and I was like, yeah, but there's always going to be, you know, somebody's going to open their garage to have a house show or something, you know, like there's just always going to exist some form of like entertainment. I mean, a lot, you know, like independent live music or something like that. So while it was such a bummer to see places get shuttered, I was like, yeah, but like music is eternal.
Yeah.
You know,
it's like the Jeff Goldblum Life Finds a Way from Jurassic
Life,
Park.
Finds a Way. Yeah, exactly. That should have been the last line of my book. God damn it. Where were you 8 months ago?
The book is great. It's called Sell Out, the major label feeding frenzy that swept punk, emo, and hardcore 1994 to 2007. Dan Ozzie is the author. Dan, where can listeners find more of your work? How can they get in touch? How can they buy your zines? Where are you at?
Oh, I got everything listed on danozzi.com. And yeah, Sell Out is the book that I would like people to buy. And I want to say also too, there's lots of stories of people taking alcohol way too far.
Yes, that we didn't even get. See, that would have been the straightforward angle, but I chose the path less traveled. Dan, how did I do with the beer industry parallel to the music industry? How do you rate this interview approach?
Great. And you know what, too, you're making me realize that like industries have like I had so many parallels with my book. I felt a kinship with the bands in it or something, like just because like when I was shopping the book around, I was like excited, but I was sort of protective of it when I was like meeting with publishing houses. And, you know, so many of the bands felt that way when they were like taking their precious album to like a label. They were like kind of skeptical about it. And then also too, you know, there's a lot of stories about labels unfolding and then getting absorbed by another label. And that happened to me, like in the course of writing my book, my publisher got like absorbed by another publisher and my editor got moved around. So like there was like, I think this kind of stuff just happens across industries where, you know, companies are buying others and they're buying little companies that are popular. And, you know, it becomes all this one big amorphous blob of capitalism at some point.
Yeah. And you wake up one day and you fucking work for Verizon.
Yeah, you're like,
accident.
What? Wait, what?
Okay. That was the Fingers interview with Dan Ozzie, music journalist and author of Sellout. Hopefully you found our conversation to be just as much fun as I did. If you want more of Dan, check out his work and buy his book at danozzie.com. That's O-Z-Z-I, danozzie.com. One last thanks to Dan for joining me on this edition of the Fingers podcast. And one more thanks to you. Yes, you. For being a brilliant and good-looking paying subscriber to Fingers and helping to support this project financially. I can't do these types of long-form interviews without that backing, and I appreciate it so, so much. Signing off from Fingers HQ, it's your fearless Fingers editor, Dave Infante, reminding you, selling out is not just a business, it's a lifestyle. Bye-bye.